You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Maria McKinley.
And I'm Doug Storm. This is the Daily Local News for Monday, January 30th, 2017.
The fact that it is absent, that food systems are absent from the current draft of the plan is somewhat troubling.
The Bloomington Food Policy Council believes nurturing local food systems should be part of the city's 2040 comprehensive plan. More on that later in today's community report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, an interview with a volunteer from Opportunity House. That's on Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community. But first, these local headlines.
Repercussions from President Trump's executive order banning refugees, immigrants, and travelers from seven Middle Eastern countries are developing around the state. Indiana University released a statement advising international students that they should suspend plans to travel outside of the United States for fear of not being able to return. We asked the chair of IU's Near Eastern Language and Culture Department, Stephen Katz, whether any faculty were currently in transit or experiencing travel difficulties. The department includes all of IU's Arabic language faculty, some of which have personal ties to the affected countries.
Not to my knowledge. At this point, no. Our concern is more with those who are being invited as guests from targeted countries, and they probably will not be allowed into the country. I know that some family members of some of our faculty are who are due today, actually, from Syria. Have been notified that they will not be allowed in, so they didn't even get on the plane. Otherwise, we advise our graduate students and our faculty who are affected not to leave the country at this point.
Professor Katz also said no faculty were in immediate danger from visa expirations or other issues that would require them to leave the country, but many overseas students are dependent on visas to enter the country to study. Some students may be unable to complete their education at IU if their visas expire and the travel ban is still in effect. The Herald Times reported that one professor, who holds citizenship in Canada and Iran and a green card in the U.S., was on the way to Tel Aviv when he saw social media reports that green card holders were being detained at airports. He canceled the rest of his trip and returned to Bloomington. Reactions to the travel ban continued to unfold around the state. On Sunday, a crowd of roughly 1,000 protesters assembled on the courthouse square to protest the ban. After a rally, the crowd marched to City Hall. This is audio that was recorded of the group assembled at the Showers Building. Some of the protesters yesterday said Bloomington should become a sanctuary city, meaning it would take steps to protect immigrants from federal immigration laws. The city's communications director, Mary Catherine Carmichael, says the city administration is exploring that possibility.
We're looking at various definitions of sanctuary city, what that means, what it doesn't mean, what the legal implications are. So it's actually a very complicated issue, and sanctuary city has kind of become a term that different communities have applied differently. So we're investigating that.
Carmichael says she expects to release a statement about the issue later this week. There's not a precise legal definition of the term sanctuary city, but most sanctuary cities prohibit law enforcement or other municipal employees from asking about a person's immigration status. Carmichael says Mayor John Hamilton is concerned about the effects of Trump's executive order.
Mayor Hamilton is deeply interested and deeply concerned about the unfortunate choices that are coming out of the White House right now. It's something he does not take lightly, and is watching what other communities are doing. Certainly pleased to see that President McRobby came out with a strongly worded statement. But again, interested in making a truly meaningful statement, not one based on anything but fact.
This afternoon, local residents began circulating a petition asking for Indiana University to take steps to protect students and faculty, including making IU a sanctuary campus. The petition had 330 signatures as of 4:45 p.m. today. Around the state, other protests were held at the Indianapolis airport and in several other cities. The airport protest included appearances from Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly and Representative Andre Carson, who is the second Muslim to be elected to Congress. Outside of Indiana, protests swept the country, focusing on major airports where incoming travelers from the banned countries were being detained. The ACLU, which obtained a court order for their release, reported raising $10 million over the weekend. In Montreal, six worshippers at a mosque were shot and killed shortly after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau declared that Canada would take refugees banned by the U.S.
The Bloomington-based Indiana Recovery Alliance is expressing serious concerns with Indiana Senate Bill 499. The bill, if passed, would allow individuals to be charged with possession of narcotics even if law enforcement finds no drugs on their person, if a person is either suffering symptoms of acute opioid overdose or if they receive an intervention drug to relieve an overdose, they could be charged with possession of a narcotic. The project coordinator for the Indiana Recovery Alliance, Chris Abert, says he believes Bill 499 would be a step back for the state of Indiana.
I think that House Bill 499 is a reversion into criminalizing people who use drugs, opposed to assisting people who use drugs and collaborating. So the idea that you could get a felony conviction only because you were resuscitated with naloxone, that be used as the standard is unfortunate.
Senate Bill 499 was introduced and authored by Senator Jeff Ratz, a Republican from Centerville. Ratz's district includes a portion of Dearborn County, which was profiled in the New York Times last year because of its unusually high incarceration rate. About one out of every 10 Dearborn County residents is in prison or jail or on probation. The Times attributed the phenomenon to, quote, a powerful prosecutor, hard-line judges, and a growing heroin epidemic, unquote. Although Abert expressed opposition to Senate Bill 499, he did say Indiana could make progress with House Bill 1438. That bill, authored by Representative Cindy Kirchhofer, would allow individual counties to approve their own needle exchange programs with limited state interference. Abert says this would be beneficial to communities around the state of Indiana.
The other law, which is going to make it easier for counties to start syringe exchanges, in many ways is a step in the right direction. It clears out some of the bureaucracy and gives more opportunity for home rule and for localities to decide, you know, what's best for their community. We'd like for it to go further.
While Abert thinks Bill 1438 is a good step, he says he thinks Indiana needs to go further. He says state legislators need to refocus on helping those with drug addictions rather than attempting to imprison them. Imprisoning people, Abert says, will only worsen the HIV and drug epidemic in the state.
We also, again, have 40 years of criminalizing people who use drugs that has led to us having the largest opiate epidemic in history, led to the largest HIV epidemic in the history of the country happening in Scott County.
Abert says he hopes Indiana might consider a Good Samaritan law in dealing with drug overdoses. Abert says people should not have to fear they could be arrested for helping another person.
Another piece of pending legislation, House Bill 1002, would increase fuel taxes and vehicle registration fees and present a potential for more highway tolling. The bill was sponsored by State Representative Ed Soliday. Last week, the House Roads and Transportation Committee voted 8-5 to send the bill to the House Ways and Means Committee. The purpose of the tax increase is to provide revenue for improvements on roads and bridges. According to the Indiana Department of Transportation, pavement and bridge conditions are expected to deteriorate without funding, and Indiana would need $1.2 billion per year for the next 20 years to keep them in fair or better condition. Indiana State Representative Matt Pierce, who represents the Bloomington area, said he will not support this bill because it would hurt lower-income residents.
Well, there are a lot of concerns and things that have to get worked out. The first issue is that the Republicans want to raise gas taxes and add vehicle registration fees that will hit the lowest-income people the most, while at the same time they're continuing a set of scheduled tax cuts for corporations and an income tax cut that will disproportionately benefit the people at the top of the income scale. So I'm not going to be supporting increasing taxes that impact people on the low end of the socioeconomic scale at the same time that we're giving breaks to people at the upper end.
Pierce said that though Indiana infrastructure needs improvement, it is unclear how money raised from taxes will be used.
Everybody in the legislature agrees that we've got a lot of infrastructure to take care of, but the issue is how you raise the money to pay for that, and then secondly, where is the money going to flow once it's raised? So the first question is, are you just going to focus in on maintaining the infrastructure you have now, or are you going to go off and do a bunch of new projects? And then secondly, is the money going to go mostly to the state highway maintenance or local governments who really have the biggest burden of maintaining county roads and city streets? How much of that money are they going to get?
The plan would increase gasoline taxes by 10 cents starting July 1st, and drivers would pay $5 more on average per month on fuel taxes and registration fees. Owners of electric cars would be charged a new $150 fee to register their vehicles.
The League of Women Voters is inviting the public to attend a legislative update this Saturday. The event takes place from 9:30 to 11 o'clock a.m. in the Bloomington City Council chambers. State legislators will be in attendance to answer questions and participate in a discussion with the audience. The League has invited all state legislators representing any part of Monroe County, but organizers say they don't know yet which lawmakers will attend. This session will be the second of five legislative updates sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Monroe County. Each session is open and free to the public. All sessions will be held in the Bloomington City Council chambers at City Hall. If you're unable to attend, Community Access Television Services will be providing videotape for replay. Future legislative updates will take place on March 4th, April 8th, and May 13th. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Maria McKinley.
And I'm Doug Storm. The city's comprehensive plan, previously known as the Growth Policies Plan, covers a broad range of topics from housing to the environment and is the guiding policy document for growth within the city. The Bloomington Food Policy Council, along with many city residents, are telling the city they believe the comprehensive plan should also address local food systems. Sarah Vaughn has that story for today's community report.
In April of 2015, the City Council endorsed the Bloomington Food Charter, a multi-year, multi-stakeholder effort to ensure people in Monroe County could have access to nutritious food. Ryan Conway is head of the steering committee of the Food Policy Council, the group that created the Bloomington Food Charter. Conway supports the idea that the city's 2040 comprehensive plan should address local food systems and specifically should include the food charter.
The food charter itself actually outlines that the city consider food as an essential component of the planning process when determining land use and transportation policies, especially in regard to ensuring that adequate access to healthful food and an increase in neighborhood access to points of local food could be insured. And so when City Council adopted this, I mean, it's meant to be a document that informs policy decision-making. So it is strange on that note that food planning and food systems have not made it into the land use and transportation portions of the current draft of the CNP. Now, what's more concerning is the fact that not only had the city endorsed the food charter, but the visioning body for the comprehensive master plan did include nurturing a vital local food system as one of its key points of things that absolutely had to be in the comprehensive plan. So noting these two policy precedents, the fact that it is absent, that food systems are absent from the current draft of the plan is somewhat troubling.
Conway says many American cities are including food systems into their master plans.
In 2014, I believe, there was an American Planning Association study done on the integration of food systems into master plans. And so we've been consulting with that research and the person who wrote that research to try and get more information that we could provide to the planning department and the planning commission and the city council to make it easier for them to process the bulk of information related to food systems planning and the hopes that they can integrate it into the plan.
When asked how city government might nurture local food systems, Conway gives two examples. First, he says being aware of Bloomington's food deserts is vital to what he calls an honest assessment of land use and food policy. Maps of Bloomington's food deserts would be an important addition to the land use chapter of the comp plan, he says. Second, Conway suggests creating agricultural innovation districts. He describes these agricultural innovation districts as a flexible overlay to existing land use categories, like the core residential or urban land use categories.
This specific kind of special district can create incentives for property owners, business owners, and residents to do things like use the arable land on their properties to cultivate food that could either be donated to local food pantries, kept for consumption in the home or an apartment complex, or even sold at the farmer's market or a neighborhood farmer's market, perhaps on weekends or especially in an area with food deserts.
The city's assistant director of planning, Scott Robinson, says people can already grow food on their own properties. As for agricultural innovation districts, he says the city will have to examine more closely where that zoning overlay might apply.
But as some people may or may not know, there's not a lot of developable land left in this corporate boundaries of the city. And so, you know, there's certainly different shapes and forms of urban agriculture and trying to identify those opportunities. You know, certainly people can participate in selling their produce at the farmer's market. You know, there's community gardens. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to look at what's out there now. Getting into the specifics of incentives or overlay districts and those things, we'd have to look at the more detailed look at that.
Will the city include the food charter in its comprehensive plan? Robinson says the plan commission will be considering it.
Well, that's something that we're considering. One of the things that staff has been working with is the plan commission. We've been scheduling work sessions with them. We haven't discussed the food policy yet. I anticipate that discussion to come up a little bit more in detail in one of our future work sessions. In the environmental chapter, you know, we did discuss some land uses and other areas, but that specific topic has not specifically been discussed. But you are correct. We did receive a lot of material or detailed information on the food policy discussion. The Environmental Commission would be one that we would look to on that. Bloomington Commission on Sustainability would be another group. You know, you mentioned food deserts. You know, there's economic development. There's a lot of different areas that this could play into. So we could certainly, again, look to leveraging those boards and commission to flesh out some of those details. One of the things that the Comprehensive Master Plan is looking to do is identify this as a first step. You know, we're not going to prescribe any things that far down the road. So again, this is mostly a direction on that first step on if food policy is an important thing for us to look at as a community, what are things that we can do to address that?
According to Conway, the last iteration of the comprehensive plan, then called the Growth Policies Plan, set a precedent for addressing local food systems.
And of course, quarter of the document is devoted towards an implementation strategy that identifies core policy goals and program goals, the timeline to completion, agencies that would be involved, what kind of funding would be needed, et cetera. And the current plan will completely lack any mention of strategic plan or strategic implementation in this respect, which is actually in violation of a core process principle that the APA has endorsed as recently as 2015 regarding accountable implementation as a key part and key process of a master plan.
Conway has also participated in the City Council's Affordable Living Study Group. He says that group has considered the availability of healthy food as an important factor in affordable living.
The committee members of council, which are Susan Sandberg, Chris Birbaum, and Tim Mayer, have been very receptive to innovative ways of adjusting zoning ordinances and other local laws to make it easier for Bloomingtonians and folks in Monterey County to access healthy, nutritious local food.
In a conversation today, City Council member Susan Sandberg said she and fellow City Council member Dave Rollo are indeed sympathetic to the issue of nurturing local food systems through public policies. Sandberg says she expects to see a host of food system-related issues up for consideration by the City Council in the coming months. But the City of Bloomington is more than a decade behind schedule in producing an updated comprehensive plan. The city's last comprehensive plan, the Growth Policies Plan, was updated in 2002. Conway worries that in the push to get an updated comp plan, city administrators might not be giving the issue of food systems much attention. Robinson says he hopes to have the next draft version of the comp plan available in late spring, but couldn't say whether a food charter will be included.
We are still working hard with the plan commission to get their feedback on the current draft that's posted online. Staff is coordinating that feedback along with the public comments received to make revisions. And then we hope to have a draft hopefully later this spring.
The review process for finalizing the 2040 Comprehensive Plan is extensive, and Robinson said he doesn't have a final deadline for it. He notes, though, that approximately 190 amendments were proposed to the Growth Policies Plan while it was being approved in 2002 by the Plan Commission and the City Council. Robinson said the public will have more opportunities to review the next draft of the 2040 Comp Plan after it's made public this spring. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
A draft version of the city's 2040 comprehensive plan is available at bloomington.in.gov/CMP.
Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service, now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Support also comes from Growing Opportunities, a social business project of the South Central Community Action Program. Growing Opportunities is an urban hydroponic farm that provides job training opportunities for low-income people with barriers to employment, especially people with disabilities. They grow produce that is sold to local eateries, supermarkets, hospitals, and schools. Information available at 812-332-2168 or online at insccap.org.
Now it's time for Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community.
Welcome to Activate, featuring tales of inspiration from local citizens who stand up for what they believe in and encouraging you to find your cause, live your passion, make a difference, volunteer.
Hi, I'm Jill Argenbright. I'm chairman of the board of the Opportunity House. We have housewares, we have clothing, and the new people that were moving into the new apartments for the homeless down south of town, and they came in to fill their vouchers. They were so excited. They were getting an apartment to live in, getting off the streets, and you know, that's what it's all about, helping the people in town. And you know, and not only just helping the underprivileged, you know, we have teachers, professors, we have all range of people come to get bargains, you know, and to see what we've put out that day, knowing that our clothes are, you know, don't have holes or tears or anything like that in them. So with the economy the way it is today, we're getting a lot of people shopping just because they don't want to pay the high prices at the store. And I had no idea, really, that there were that many people that needed assistance. Because, you know, we donate clothes to Shalom and different organization where they distribute them to other areas of need, you know, for whatever their circumstance may be. They really need this help. And then we get the middle class and the teachers coming in and say, oh, what you got on sale today? You know, looking for a good bargain. We are a totally volunteer-run organization. We have volunteers that sit around a big table and price and have a good time and talk kind of like the old quilting bee, you know. We have students from IU and from Ivy Tech. We have interns. They put it on their resume as being an intern in a nonprofit organization, which looks really good on their resume after they graduate. So it's a real boom for kids to be doing that. We also have Harmony School. We have a couple of students in their middle school grades, and they come every other Wednesday and volunteer and price clothes for us. So it's a good experience for anybody. Everyone, even the students that have done it for us, they always want to come back. They say, oh, call us if you need us again, or if, you know, we can come for another so many week period. So they enjoy it as well as we enjoy having them. We're always in need of good volunteers. So we really appreciate our volunteers, and they stay with us as long as they can. Our volunteers do have a good time, and we've been praised for having the cashiers being the friendliest in town. So we do appreciate all of our volunteers. All of our profits goes to, you know, Monroe County United Ministries, their preschool, their food bank, their emergency services of people that are in need. Well, I would just like to extend an invitation to anyone not only to come shop with us, but we'd also love to have you come and join our volunteers. We need more volunteers. We've increased our donations. Now we just need to get it priced and out in the store. So, you know, anyone that would be willing to volunteer a few hours a week would just be wonderful to help us out. We'd certainly appreciate it. And I think they'd have a good time. Thanks for listening. I'm Jill Argenbry, chairman of the Opportunity House.
You've been listening to Activate, a co-production of WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, working together to build an empowered, vibrant, and engaged community. You may visit bloomington.in.gov/volunteer to find and sign up for local volunteer opportunities. All episodes of Activate are available online at wfhb.org/news/activate. For Bloomington Community Radio, I'm Jennifer Brooks.
This has been the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jared Dill, Wes Martin, Joe Crawford, Jade Schoppel, Dominic Jean, and Sheila Raghavendran. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
Activate is produced by Jennifer Brooks, along with the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network. Our engineer is Sarah Hetrick. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Doug Storm.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming, online at wfhb.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
If you use iTunes, you can have this show delivered directly to you. Just go to the iTunes store, search for WFHB Daily Local News, and subscribe to our podcast.
Stay tuned for Bring It On, our local forum on African American people and culture, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.